Hello, and welcome to the All Bets Are Off podcast, a gambling addiction recovery podcast brought to you by those with lived experience. If you're here and having difficulties with gambling, please reach out. There are plenty of people on your side. There's a comprehensive list of support services over on our website, www.allbetsareoff.co.uk. It's now time to crack on with the pod.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the penultimate podcast of season three of the All Bets Are Off podcast, in which Chris Gillam and I have been joined by former first-class cricketer, come director of educational programmes at Epic Risk Management. By God, that's a mouthful. Mr. Patrick Foster. And alongside him, we have longtime Hampshire cricketer Chris Wood, who also has a role at Epic as a pro sports facilitator. Now, firstly, gents, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedules to join us today.
No worries. It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
And so all four of us here have one thing in common, I guess, and it's certainly not our cricketing prowess, that's for sure. could the both of you start by outlining your own experiences with gambling addiction?
Go for it, Pat.
So mine was a little bit different to a lot of people. In that I didn't start until I was 19 years old. I'd never really gambled as a young person. I'd not been exposed to it and wasn't part of my upbringing, really. I then placed my first bet at university, age 19, on a FOB team machine. Put a £2 bet on Green Zero. It came in. £2 came £72. And obviously my life changed forever. From that moment on, a day didn't go past where I didn't have a bet in some form. At the time, I was playing professional cricket. I had a year left on my contract. And unfortunately, at the end of that year, things didn't go as I wanted to and I got released. And that moment hit me really hard. I found it really difficult. And I guess that then changed my relationship again with gambling, because now I went back to university. I didn't have the same focus, motivation, but also I needed to try and replicate the buzz, the rush, the hit that I used to get from playing sport, and gambling was actually the closest thing I could find. And I started to do it more and more, but I was also in a fortunate position in that I'd been paid to play cricket. So I had more money than most students, and I always made the mistake of judging it financially. Graduated, went into the city, I worked in insurance. And of course, what came with that was a culture and lifestyle that was kind of, that was part of it, getting paid a pretty handsome salary for someone my age. And then in December 2010, things changed again when I won £35,000 off a football accumulator one night. And of course, that changed my relationship again, in that I then, from that moment on, thought I was invincible. I thought that was going to happen every time I placed a bet. When I lost, I thought, well, that doesn't matter, I'll win it all back at some point. But actually, that's when it also became like a drug, because I had to put bigger bets on to try and get that feeling. And to cut a long story short, I lost it in 5 weeks. And when I'd lost it, I would try to win it back, and didn't start to lose. And life started to spiral out of control and move in a very different direction. 6 months later, I changed my career in the hope that changing my lifestyle would get rid of the problem. But actually, it just made it worse in many ways, because financially, I wasn't getting paid the amount of money that I was, and still trying to gamble at the same rate. And over the next few years, I'd build up huge amounts of debt, like a lot of people do, open up multiple accounts. And of course, probably the worst part of it was that my mental health was severely affected. I didn't have any issue recognizing I had a problem, because it was pretty obvious, because the situation I was in, I was just too ashamed, embarrassed to do anything about it. I didn't think help was possible. I didn't know where to get it. My biggest fear was being found out, and eventually I did in March 2018, when my employers found out about what was going on, and I knew I was going to lose my job and my house. I thought I might go to prison for what I was doing, because I'd started to borrow huge sums of money off people that have parents of pupils that I taught. And I panicked. I tried to gamble my way out of the problem, like most gamblers do, is they think that the thing that's got you in there is going to get you out of it. And I ended up putting a £50,000 bet on a horse race in March 2018 that didn't win. And of course, my world came crashing down. I attempted suicide in March 2018, fortunately failed, and reached out to my younger brother, who persuaded me not to do what I was about to do. And I was one of the lucky ones who didn't. And ended up in treatment in London, where I spent the next 4 weeks, along with a lot of therapy, counselling, etc., piecing my life back together. And I've been in recovery ever since. So, yeah, that's a long story told as quickly as I could. But yeah, one that I look back on and sort of can't believe I made the mistake of thinking that problems like that didn't happen to me. But actually, as we all know, it doesn't discriminate. And yeah, I mean, I've learned a huge amount about myself, but also about that world that kind of took over my life and very nearly destroyed it.
Yeah, nice patch. And similarly for me, actually, in the fact that gambling wasn't a huge part of my life at all growing up. And I actually had my first bet, like a lot of people do, was with friends, and it was actually illegally. So as a 17-year-old, and it was just going down to bookmakers with some friends for football, placing £10 on a football accumulator, going off to football, checking my bet slip, realising it had lost, and no real feelings and emotions attached to it at that stage. Then it progressively started going every weekend, and then I got a significant amount of money for my 18th birthday, saved up for my dad's mum, and I'd spent that in the next 4 or 5 weeks, and I was now going down in between college classes and after college, and it was starting to become an activity I was doing on my own, not just with my friends at the weekend. And I quickly identified it was kind of the place I wanted to be. I felt safe for some reason in the bookmakers. Again, I've got that buzz from the bookmakers that I get from cricket. And still yet to this day, ever since I've had my last bet, I still haven't found a buzz like gambling other than cricket. And I guess it kind of just materialised from there. And then I got the first professional contract and my mentality started to change. It was very much, it was now my money and I could do whatever I wanted with it. And that was how I spent every single month's wage, really. I'd moved down to Southampton and I rented off a couple of friends. I had a lease on a car. Then every other penny I earned via them, bread, rice, any of the cheap food you can imagine, all went towards gambling. And then I guess my career got relatively successful quite early. We won 3 1-day trophies before I was even 23 years old. And that just enabled my gambling even more, because when you win trophies in cricket, you obviously win prize money. And it just enabled the activity to continue, really. And I kind of went through cricket winging it. I reached out at a few various occasions, but ultimately I just wasn't grown up enough or hadn't gone deep enough to actually really want to put it down and stop. And it wasn't till kind of 2016 when I finally got fit to play 4-day cricket, and I was running into bowl and collapsing in the middle of the wicket and trying to pick myself up and go back to my mark and run into bowl and keep collapsing. And then it started to turn really bad for me. I was in the last year of my contract. I wasn't quite sure where my career was going to go. I thought I was going to get to October and Hampshire were just going to release me. That obviously wasn't the case, but it's all you think about is the negatives when you're in the mix of addiction and you're just trying to find your way out. And I very much thought that I was going to be out into the real world with nothing behind me. And it just enabled me to gamble further. And that's when I started to get the thoughts of, is life really worth living? You know, all the hurt you're causing on yourself, but everyone around you. And I still decided to continue for the next couple of years, albeit not to quite as large a scale financially, but it became very more secretive. Like I had people checking my account, but I'd find external ways, whether it was coaching or cashback, which was a master plan of mine, you know, going to Sainsbury's or Co-op and getting X amount of cashback, and it shows on your bank statement as Sainsbury's or Co-op. But then kind of my last bet was actually for just £15, a football accumulator. And it just 11 years of that sort of hurt, pain that I caused myself. And I walked out of that bookmaker's that day after that £15, it was just completely sapped out of me. And the bet hadn't even started, let alone sort of any of the legs of the bet coming in. And I just went over to the bin and I tore it up and I threw it in there. And that's when I really knew that enough's enough and I need to move forward, not just for myself, but everyone around me.
Brilliant. Thanks for that, Chris. And forgot to mention in my introduction as well, congratulations on your recent selection in the 100 draft, I must say. Big up for that. And Patrick, it's quite interesting actually, because I think when you got to the brink, it was literally a few miles away from myself at Slough Station. So it's incredible how things sort of kind of go full circle, and here we are on the podcast today. But yeah, glad you're around to tell the tale. And I'm going to hand over to Chris actually, because I think he wants to raise a couple of points actually. So yeah.
Well, first thing I want to say is thanks for coming on, guys. I'm a big cricket fan myself, and I feel a bit sorry for Ryan here, because I think he thinks he's got two great sportsmen with him. He's actually got three, because I retired on a 50 So there we go. I thought this is a good time. This is a good time to get out of the game. I was about 18 then, and I'm 39 now. But you know, it was a great innings, and I still hold a 200 meters record at school. Do you know what I mean? So I feel sorry for Ryan. I really, really do. Some of the stuff you guys just said there, though, really resonated with me. You know, both of you said you didn't gamble until you were a bit older. There was nothing around gambling in your childhood. Mine was very similar. We used to go down the local beach, me and my family, down to Southend. And my dad and my brother would go in the arcades and play, and I'd stand outside with my mum. Had no interest at all. But by the time I was 30, I was totally hooked. You know, I mean, I don't know how that happened, because it wasn't something that I ever thought I would be doing. And I was depressed at that time as well. I really was depressed. And depression within cricket is something that has been widely spoken about over the years, actually, with the likes of, you know, Marcus Trescothick, Steve Harmison, Freddie Flintoff and others. They've spoken candidly about their own battles. And of course, there is some crossover with the gambling addiction as well, in terms of possible depression and using gambling as a coping strategy, perhaps. Of course, without mentioning any names, do you know of any other cricketers that you've played with, or some you may not have done, who have had a problematic relationship with gambling?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly imagine Woody could probably speak more, because he's had a much longer and more successful career than I ever did. I certainly know that it's something that goes on in the game, not just from my sort of time doing it, but also from the work that we do now. And I was certainly aware of a lot of people that did it. I think one of the issues is that people are worried about speaking up, because they're worried not just about the kind of stigma attached, which we all know about, but I think it's the fear of what the consequences might be. I think those people think that they've got so much to lose, because a lot of them are living their dream in playing sport at that level. And I think that's what stops a lot of people speaking up. But we both know that it's something that kind of goes on. We know that a lot of people tread a very thin line. And actually, my biggest concern for a lot of people is actually when they transition out of the game. I think that's one of the worst parts. Everybody has to make that transition at some point, as I did very quickly. And I found that very tough. And I think that's where a lot of people will get found out. It's not something that there's been a huge number of people that have talked about it, but hopefully by sort of Chris and I leading the way, more people will. But I guess Woody will know, or maybe have seen more people who are doing it through his career.
Yeah, I don't think I know any other cricketer who's put their hand up and said they're a problematic gambler. I believe I was the first one when I came up with my podcast last April. I know it goes on, and I'm sure it does in all sports. I see sometimes when I think it's potentially erratic gambling, but no one other as such that has sort of reached out to me directly and said that they've got their own issues and are dealing with them themselves. But I think we all know that's the case, right? If people aren't ready, they internalise it so much, like I'm sure all us four on this call did for a period of time. And I think that's the hardest thing for me is seeing people that you could potentially be struggling, and you're feeling for them, but they're just not at that stage where they're ready to sort of put their hand up and do something about it. They need to sort of investigate, like we all did, deeper before you've caused enough pain to then actually put your hand up, which is a real shame.
For sure. And just to go back earlier on, actually, I wasn't there to defend myself when Chris was talking about cricket and stuff. You know, back in the day, I was sort of kind of like a medium-paced left arm. I considered myself a bit of an Alan Mullally back in the day. That's how I presented myself in the school team, at least. Terrible with a bat, though. But no, it's interesting that you should say all of this. I mean, Patrick, I know we spoke in a pre-recording, and you know, I did do a little bit of research ahead of the show, and you know, cricketers do earn quite good money, but it's fair to say that, you know, county cricketers, you know, some of them are literally earning, I'd say, sort of national average sort of wages. And I think the additional competitions and franchises that sort of then come into it is where, you know, it sort of takes off a little bit more. Do you think that this might sort of inadvertently create that aura of pressure in itself, and could be a bit dog eat dog, and that's why cricketers might not feel comfortable at speaking out at that? Because it's not like, for example, top level football, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting you should say that. I would say with cricket, there's a few reasons why people are potentially drawn to it. I think the first is obviously financially, particularly for some of the younger guys who may see other guys that sort of a bit more successful, earn a bit more money for the reasons that you've just said. And they think that gambling's possibly a way of kind of accelerating that process. I think we've all been there as young people, particularly when you win or have success, that you think, do you know what, this is something I can actually make money from. And I think that does drive some of the younger people. I also think that the pressures of sport, it's a very fickle world. Contracts last for short periods of time. And when you're under that pressure, as Chris just said at one point, he was, I think that's something. But I think one of the unique things about cricket is kind of the lifestyle that comes with it. And the fact that it's a sport that you play, but as some people kind of talk about a lot, it takes an awful long time. And you have a lot more downtime, even whilst you're playing. If you're anything like me, you get out pretty quickly and you then sat around doing nothing for hours watching other people. And if you play it, you're pretty bored of watching it. And actually, you then start to spend that time doing things like gambling. The fact that you can do it on your phone means that you can kind of do it any place, any time. Also, I remember going around places, weird and wonderful places in the country, and being in hotels. You got a lot of time on your own. You're generally people that don't like being bored and you want to fill that time. So I think that the lifestyle that comes with cricket, and also it's a sport that unusually you fail probably more than you succeed. And it's mentally very tough. So you need a kind of release, a form of escapism. So I think that's what you couple all those things together. And I think that's what drives a lot of cricketers to it. But yeah, I would say particularly with the younger guys, it can often be a financial incentive, which we all know is not a sensible one.
Chris, did you ever feel that particular way? You know, when you put all of those things in the melting pot, did you ever feel under that sort of pressure?
Well, certainly when I started off gambling, when I was young, and I earned probably $7,500 as my first professional contract or a development contract before I've moved on to a full contract. I'm very competitive, kind of win v losing mentality. And when I started gambling at an early stage with those little amounts of money, I always just thought I could win. And when I lose, it wasn't enough. I always just tried to chase and always thought I could end up winning. I think one of the points that Patch highlighted on there about the sort of how many good days and bad days you have in a given season, I think that is absolutely huge. At least in like other sports, team sports like football, rugby, you can have an average game but still come out on the other side having won the game of football, and it doesn't really get to shine a light on your kind of performance. I know that's getting a bit more in depth now, but kind of some cricketers will only have sort of 7-8 good days a year. Across the summer, which lasts 6 months. And that's a crazy amount, really, for in professional sport, just to have that sort of handful of experiences of good throughout a summer. And all those other times can be relatively negative. And we know that a lot of people gamble on negative thoughts. I certainly did. And it just kind of fuels the experience and fuels the fire more.
There's a couple of really interesting things there that have got me thinking, you know, because I was a gambler who would gamble when things were great or when things weren't very good. So I can imagine being out there and getting my ton and coming in, and then, you know, first thing I'm doing is I'm gambling, or equally, you know, I've got my duck and it's the same thing. But another thing that really, really interested me there that you were saying, Patrick, was about gambling during the game, because you're in the dressing room, you've got a lot of time. And I'm thinking of myself sitting, because I go to Trent Bridge whenever there's a test up there. I've got a friend who lives in Nottingham. I'll sit there, and not anymore, hasten to add, but I would have sat there gambling some years just on my phone, because you can gamble for 5 days in a row at a test match. It's absolutely mad, isn't it? But I've never thought about me doing that while, I know some of these players may or may not have been, who knows, but people doing it in the dressing room as well. I can't really think of another sport where you're gambling at the same time as maybe somebody who's playing in that actual match, which is something that hadn't crossed my mind before, to be honest. Really, really strange. Really strange.
I guess that sort of leads on to our next question. And really intrigued to hear what a cricketer's changing room is like and the general makeup of it. You know, from books that I've read a few cricketing autobiographies in my time and interviews that I've seen, as an outsider, it seems like a type of place that you need to sort of grow up fast, probably more so than a lot of other sports. And now, not to say that everyone who plays cards, for example, there might have been card games going on, or anyone who has a bet has a gambling disorder, as we know that's far from the case. But are card games and groups of those who like to have a bet quite common? And as a younger player, might you ever feel a bit of pressure to fit in?
Yeah, I think just from my experience, I've been in the game for 14 years, it certainly happens. You know, poker on the bus to four-day games, a lot of horse racing. The guys seem to love their horse racing, but I see that across most sports now. I wouldn't say when I walked into a changing environment, I necessarily felt pressured into gambling like a lot of the senior guys did. But what I would say is I was very much a sheep. So me being the guy that I was and looking up to certain people, and maybe subconsciously or whatever, felt like that was the right thing to do to try and be liked or get involved. I know that wasn't the case, but that was kind of my mindset around it for sure. But it definitely goes on. I'd say at least sort of 75%, 80% of people in my change room gamble to some extent. But that could be, like you say, £2 on a football accumulator at the weekend, and it means absolutely nothing, and it is just what it is. But I don't think I'd be speaking out of turn if it wasn't similar in most change rooms, probably in most sports, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree with what Woody said there in terms of it's definitely something that goes on. I also look back to times and think of times where, again, the weird sport that we both played and love is that you can't play when it's raining. And when there are rain delays, I know that's how a lot of people filled their time. Was kind of logging onto their phone and having a bet or playing a game of poker or cards, that kind of thing. So I think it is part of the culture. But I think it's also changed a little bit in that I think historically drinking was like a big part of kind of the culture. But like all sports, it's professionalized a lot. And these guys are now sort of highly tuned athletes. So I can never have claimed to be one of those, but actually it's now one of the things that people or younger guys do as their kind of release. Whereas I think historically it was probably often kind of drinking, and not saying that that's good, but I think that means that a lot of people now gamble as their kind of release. And we've certainly seen that pattern in other sports as well, because people think, well, oh, it's gambling, it only affects money, I don't need to worry about it. It's not going to affect my sort of me physically, or I'm not going to get tested for gambling like I'll get tested for drugs. And I think that's where the education element is so important, because as we all know, it affects you in different ways that are just as harmful.
During our discussion with Chris and Patrick, we didn't pause for a break. And given that this is around about the halfway stage, I sort of figured that would throw it in here and big up Gamban. But please stay tuned, because after the break, we'll pick up the conversation from exactly where we left it.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to us today. The All Bets Are Off podcast is brought to you in association with Gamban, and they've teamed up with GamCare and GamStop to formulate TalkBanStop. The TalkBanStop campaign offers a trio of free tools to prevent gambling harm. With support via GamCare's National Gambling Helpline, free Gamban blocking software, and GamStop self-exclusion. Head to www.talkbanstop.com for more information. TalkBanStop is only available in the UK, but to block your devices from accessing gambling sites and apps, you can get Gamban at gamban.com or on the App Store or Play Store, wherever you are in the world. Now though, it's time to get back into the pod.
Hello everyone, and welcome to part two of today's podcast. I wanted to pick up exactly where we left off just before the break and what Patrick was saying, and that centres around culture, drinking, and indeed gambling. Now, I'm not sure from the top of my head what the statistics are nowadays regarding English county cricket and how many South Asian players there are in the game. Now, assuming that there are South Asian players in the dressing room and they may be strict and practising their religious beliefs, what was or is their attitude towards this culture of gambling and indeed drinking?
Yeah, I've experienced obviously some of that, and I just feel they distance themselves, to be honest. They're so sort of straightforward thinking, and like you say, stick to very much their beliefs. I'd probably actually like to have a conversation with one of the ones that I've played with along the time and see if they actually felt uncomfortable in that environment. But in all honesty, I don't know the answer. They're so good at keeping themselves kind of away from that sort of given situation, whether it was alcohol or gambling. You just kind of respected their decision that it wasn't something they did, kind of thing.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think it's also interesting that it's a game that's played all around the world, and culturally people come from different parts of the world. I know in my experience, I've come across a lot of Australians where gambling is very normalized. A lot of them love it. It's part of what they do. Whereas actually, interestingly, say South Africans that I've played with, some of them, they're not interested whatsoever. It's not something that they do. So it's quite interesting that within those change rooms, there's so many different kind of cultures within it, and gambling kind of plays a different part. I think with regards to what Chris said around the kind of religious element, one of the things that concerns me about people generally when it comes to gambling is that in some religions, it's obviously against that religion, but yet they might be doing it. And is that another reason why they're not prepared to speak up or talk about it, and are kind of suffering in silence because they're worried about what the consequences of talking about it would? And we work in education and with young people in schools, I see that. And it's such a taboo subject in that world. It worries me even more. I mean, it's enough of a taboo subject in society, but in those cultures, I think sometimes does it go on, but are people not talking about it because they're so worried about what's going to happen if they do?
Now, you're spot on there. I mean, I really, really worry as well that people are gambling who may have specific beliefs, and it makes it even harder for them to come forward. And you're absolutely right. And within that dressing room environment, it might be that some people are doing it and not even joining in with the others because they feel they can't, but they want to kind of feel a part of what's going on. But equally, it shouldn't really matter about beliefs, religion, all that kind of stuff. You want everyone to feel welcome and comfortable within that dressing room environment. So I guess as a team, that's what you really, really want to do. And maybe the gambling that's going on, people don't realise it, but that is making people feel a little bit on the outside, you know, a little bit on the outside, whether that's meant to be done or not. I'm going to move on to the next question now. Given that cricket is not necessarily the most well-paid of sports, do you think that cricket would ever be more susceptible to illegal betting rings? Or do you think that the risk reward wouldn't necessarily be worth it?
Well, we've seen it happen. You could say it's potentially more susceptible, but I just think the risks and the punishments are just so overwhelming, and like they should be. I'm not condoning it. But if you get caught in that kind of environment, as we've seen the likes of Mohammed Amir back in the day, and just those kind of things who do get caught up in it somehow, I just think the punishments are so severe. So you could say maybe more susceptible, but I certainly don't believe that really goes on, to be honest.
I think the interesting thing with the kind of gambling and cricket is that I think it went through a stage where a lot of it was going on, or more of it going on, particularly when kind of betting in play first came into action, and there was the opportunity and scope to kind of spot fix. But I think like in every sport, I think players that don't have a problem with it, I think they're so now aware that they'll get found out. They know that the consequences, as Woody said, are going to be pretty brutal, potentially career ending, and possibly rightly so. I think where the real risk is for those problematic gamblers that are desperate. I think back, and I always say it now, it pains me to admit it, but if I was playing and someone had offered me that in the financial situation that I was in, I probably would have said, yeah, absolutely, I'd do it. And I wouldn't have cared about anybody else. And that's sad. And I think that's what worries me in sport, is that people who are in that situation can be taken advantage of. But I think so much is being done in that area on the integrity side of things that is positive and moving it in the right direction. But we have seen these horror stories that Woody alluded to about these these guys that are making a mistake. And sometimes I think it probably is driven by the fact that they've got issues going on rather than it being kind of ignorance, which often it's put down to, which I don't think helps.
100%. And just away from cricket for a moment, I know that earlier on at the top of the show that you spoke, well, you gave a brief history with regards to your addiction to gambling. Could you tell us a bit about your methodologies that you subsequently applied to your recoveries and what you found worked well for yourselves?
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, it was obviously, I was very fortunate. I always say fortunate. I mean, it's fortunate and unfortunate in that I ended up in sort of pretty significant treatment back in March 2018. Those 4 weeks that kind of changed or saved my life were huge for me, because I was in a very kind of safe and protected environment where obviously I wasn't able to gamble, but I was able to really sort of have a long, hard look at myself, understand why I was doing it. But that gave me a lot of strategies that I could then utilize when I went back into the kind of real world. And one of the best things about that is you weren't kind of told, well, this is what you have to do, but these are all the different things that you can use to ensure that recovery continues. And for lots of them, I've continued them as a kind of ongoing process. Some of them I did in the kind of immediate aftermath, I did most of them. But what they did was they gave me the kind of tools and strategies to keep going. I mean, I'm a big believer in recovery being such an individual thing. It doesn't matter what you do if it works for you. And obviously, I know lots of people that go to things like GA, which I did a huge amount of when I first stopped, less so now. But that's not because I don't think it works. It's for practical reasons more than a lot of things. But for me, a big part is using a kind of support network that I have, talking to people, and obviously the job that I do helps, because I'm doing that all the time and I'm surrounded by people who've been in similar situations. I do things I don't think I'll ever be able to replicate, the feeling it gave me, the rush and buzz, but I do things that, well, my addiction manifests itself in weird and wonderful ways that have positive effects on me and other people. I now play a lot more sport again. I do a lot more exercise. I run, things like that, that are good for mind and body. Obviously, gratitude plays a huge part in it, because I think back to where I was and where I am now, and constantly reminding myself of that helps. So, yeah, there's lots of different things that I use. And, yeah, it tends to be kind of, I don't have sort of set routine. I think routine is important, but I don't kind of, it's what feels right at the time, and just staying on top of it, really, always prioritizing it. Because I think the second you get complacent, particularly when you're still reasonably early in recovery like me, is the second that you could slip up, and I don't want that to happen, that's for sure.
Yeah, nice, Patch. I guess mine was similar-ish in the fact it started in recovery, but I wasn't in residential, so I didn't move in for a period of time. I actually went through the Sporting Chance platform, which sort of is for professional sportsmen. Extremely lucky, I went on to have sort of 15 to 18 one-to-one therapy sessions. And then from there, I kind of started my journey in GA. I started going to a place in Chichester. I got advised of GA quite a long time before I actually grew some balls and kind of reached out, but I was always had such a huge ego that I didn't want to go to GA. It's people who are low lives, you know, homeless and all that kind of thing. And I didn't want someone to necessarily recognize who I was and that I was a professional sportsman, and would I get judged and would it get back quicker and all that kind of thing. But when I kind of dropped my guard and walked through that door, and you know, you got clapped by everyone there, and you had lawyers there and policemen and all kind of people. And that's for me when I first found my identity and knew that I wasn't the only person in the world that had an addiction, because I very much thought that I was the only person for a long time. And then I kind of went on to sort of delve into the program, the recovery program, and I got a sponsor. And I guess that relationship, like Patch said, I've now got that support network around me. I don't go to a live GA meeting as such anymore, but I do a steps-based recovery meeting every single week, which I kind of feel the need that I need to stick to. And it's everyone that's done the program, because I started to get a little bit frustrated in GA in the respect that not everyone does a program. Not saying doing a program is right or wrong, but by not doing it, for me, you're not necessarily essentially changing. And that's part of the whole journey. Is I became this person over 11 years of gambling, sort of ripped me from top to bottom, and I essentially needed to change to stop the act of gambling. So I kind of went through that journey and I got the sponsor, and I now speak to my sponsor 4, 5, 6 times a week, or if I need to, 2 or 3 times a day. If difficult sort of situations arise that I used to run away and gamble, I now know that that doesn't have to be the answer. And I can just pick up the phone to anybody, even if it's Patch or my sponsor, or you just got that, you start to gather, don't you, that sort of tight-knit group that when you do feel under the pump or you feel like you're going backwards or you're reverting to your old ways, that you can just kind of pick up your phone and take the power out of it. And that's kind of my experience, and I'll continue to do what I do now for the foreseeable future, for sure.
I love the answers that both of you have given there. I really, really do. You're right. It's individual in my mind as well. It's, you know, it is an individual journey. And I always look at it that it's a journey for me now, and I enjoy that journey. I love that journey. Some things on that journey are hard. Some things are not so hard, but I love it. And, you know, I can really relate to what you said there, Chris, about walking in that GA room the first time, because I remember walking in and it was like, ah, look at all this lot who are really happy and have all got really good jobs, and, you know, they're all smiling and all this kind of stuff. And it's not what I expected. And in fact, my meeting starts in 1 hour. So when we finish recording this episode, I'm on my way there, and I still go every week and I love it. But, you know, as time's gone by, I've grown that network, and it is the network that I find important. You're talking about picking up the phone, talking to people. You know, I talk to the GA people loads, but equally, I talk to Ryan now. I'm talking to you guys today. It's like living recovery, and it's a wonderful thing to do. And you guys have got that as well through the work you're doing. No, I think that's really, really special. And recovery should be individual. And, you know, they hear the words now, discovery and all that kind of stuff being used. And I love that. You know, it really, really is a great thing. But I want to ask, what advice would you give to any young player coming into the game that is starting to exhibit signs of problematic relationships with gambling?
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective as somebody who was that person who was kind of young, who had those opportunities, it's really making the most of those opportunities and not letting things get in the way that don't need to be there. And I think gambling is one of those things. So in all honesty, my advice would be to not do it, because I think it's a distraction that doesn't need to be there in that person's position. But it's not as simple as that sometimes. And I think obviously trying to find other outlets that possibly are similar is really important. But also if you're having an issue with it early on, is do something about it the second you realise that there's a problem. And that's obviously something that through the work we do, we try and encourage people to do something about it early, because I genuinely believe that intervention is possible early, and you can stop and you can do something about it. You don't have to wait till you get to the edge of the cliff or a train platform like me to do something about it. And actually, the problem might be tiny. You might not have any debt. You might not have the scars that we've all got from doing it for an awful long time. So I think reaching out for help at the earliest possible moment is the best advice you can give someone. And taking that step is tough. We all know it. It takes a bit of bravery and courage, but it's the best thing you'll ever do. And it will save people's careers. So I think that would be my advice, more than anything else, in all honesty.
Yeah, definitely. And I think mine is similar, to be honest, in the fact that I would try and sort of advise them not to do it first and foremost. But as Patch said, that's not an easy thing to do, certainly when people are just trying to discover their relationship with it. But I guess the one thing I would do now is ask someone, if I thought they were doing it too much, why they're doing it, and try and get them to think, what's the reason that they're gambling? Is it because they're trying to escape life? Or they can't deal with the fact that they're getting naught every week, or not taking any wickets and a drop to the second team? Or are they gambling 10, 20 quid every week and it's manageable and they're doing it because their friends are doing it and it's just the enjoyment? So I try and get them to kind of work out why they're doing it. That would be my first port of call. But I guess for me, part of the reason I came out and told everyone my story is because I don't want to see people do what I did. come in, start gambling from an early age, and 11 years further down the line, you've got nothing to show for it, and you've had this quite successful career and essentially nothing, like I said, to really show for it. And that's the last thing I want for certainly anyone at Hampshire, but any young aspiring cricketer. And that's kind of the reason that I've joined Epic, and I've just sort of finished the 18 counties academies, and that's the kind of message I'm trying to get across.
Love that, inspiring the future generation, and making them understand their relationship with gambling first and foremost. Before we start wrapping up, I wanted to explore, well, I'm keen to explore the support and awareness raising of, I mean, you just touched upon the stuff that you're doing with Epic, of the domestic cricketing authorities and the Professional Cricketers Association. What have we seen that's, how has it evolved over the years? What has changed over the years? Have things improved? And if so, how? And could things get any better? And if so, how?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're both fortunate because we've benefited from the help from the Professional Cricketers Association. And as a player body, they are incredible, provide amazing support for players, not just present players like Woody, but also myself, who'd been out of the game for 10 years, who was pretty useless. The support they gave you was kind of incredible. I think what they've done really well is kind of be proactive. They recognise that this is an issue and something going on. When I was playing, there was no education whatsoever about gambling. But actually there is now, and that's a step in the right direction. They recognise it's something that is obviously normalised in society, but also something that goes on in the game. So I think that's a hugely positive step and something that's definitely really good, and you've seen other sports follow suit, but I would say that cricket has kind of taken a lead in terms of the education side of things. They're also very good at kind of ensuring that message isn't just sort of told once and that's it. It's kind of revisiting, talking about links with betting integrity, etc. So we've certainly seen it done well. It's some sports, I think, have been more reactive. They've waited till there's problems or its ugly head rears itself and then they do something about it. But I would say cricket has taken a lead in it. Of course, more can be done. And I think part of that is more to protect players. Education is important, but also making sure that actually there's ways that kind of as sponsorship and that kind of thing comes into the game is recognizing that with that exposure comes more temptation, etc. So doing what they can to protect players, I think, is important and will be a focus going forward.
I'm not sure I can add an awful lot to that, to be honest. That was actually pretty spot on, but it's ever evolving. But like Patch said, it needs to continue to do so for sure.
Yeah, and I think getting them young as well. Woody's done a great program this year with the academies. I think that's brilliant, is that actually they're getting this message when they're 15, 16, when they're starting their careers, before they've started gambling, rather than when they're 23 and they've already been doing it for however many years and the bad habits are ingrained. So I think actually working with young people, and of course we all know that people are doing it at a younger age because of the different ways that they can do it, but I think that's massive as well, and something that's really important is getting them young.
Totally, and that work that Woody's doing there is fantastic. Like you say, you've got to get them young to really help them out, and also really great to hear how kind of proactive the Professional Cricketers Association are being. You know, that's really, really great, and if they're ever evolving and trying to make things better and better, that's absolutely superb. But I guess lastly, I better ask you a quick question, or Paul might have a pop at us. Joking, of course. Apart from the work that we've just spoken about there that Woody's been doing, how are things at Epic Risk Management, and just how much do you enjoy doing what you're doing with them?
Yeah, I mean, my role's obviously a bit different to Woody in that he's still got his playing career. I love what I do, and I don't sort of say that lightly. I genuinely love it. It helps me from a selfish point of view, but also I'm hopefully helping other people, making a real difference, giving something back, having taken an awful lot away and turning what was a negative into a positive. The business has evolved massively over the last sort of best part of 3 years that I've been involved, and it's obviously got bigger. We're working in more areas, but ultimately we still do it for the same reason, and that's to try and stop people going through what we did. And growth is exciting. It presents some challenges, but it's a special business to be part of. I always had, when I came out of rehab, a kind of burning, I always say a burning desire to share my story with people in the hope that it would help other people. But my focus has always been on young people, because I was a teacher for a long time who went through what I did. And I saw that there was a lack of education. And I always believed, some people don't, but I always believed that lived experience should play a role in educating young people. And Epic gave me the opportunity to do it. So, yeah, I'm lucky to be part of it. And yeah, it's great. And Paul didn't make me say that either.
Yeah, and just from my side, I've been working with the company, well, probably 6-7 months now. And similarly to Patch, really, I just wanted to get out there and share my experience. I said earlier that I haven't found anything that's sort of got close to a buzz, like gambling got me, apart from cricket. But actually, that's kind of telling a lie, because I do get some of the kind of feelings and emotions and the buzz that I got from gambling, from sort of spreading my story and sort of educating young guys and girls around the pitfalls that or gambling could potentially take you. So I guess that's why another reason why I do it. And also for me, cricket isn't going to go on forever. So it's sort of dipping my toes in the water now at potentially things when my career does come to an end. And Epic just gave me that opportunity to sort of get involved and go out there and sort of spread the message and hopefully, essentially, make a difference, which is, I think, what we're all here today to do, really.
And how's that for an episode?
You stole my pun. It's been brilliant. Really enjoyed today's recording. And on behalf of the ABOA team, I just wish to thank you both for coming on again. And next time, when things return to normality, I'm not too far from Hampshire. I'll make sure I get down there for a game, that's for sure.
Sounds good. Thanks for having us, guys. It was really good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Great talking to you.
And that concludes today's show and the penultimate episode of Season 3 of the All Bets Are Off podcast. Make sure you join us next week for the final installment. Until then, stay safe and remain gamble-free. And don't forget, if you are struggling with an addiction to gambling, or you're a loved one worried about someone else's relationship with gambling, then please head over to our website, where there are links to a number of support services. Bye bye for now.
You've been listening to the All Bets Are Off podcast. To find out more about the creators of the pod, then please visit our website, www.allbetsareoff.co.uk. And don't forget to give us a follow on Twitter at allbetsareoff_, and share this podcast with others. Until next time, stay safe and remain gamble free. Thank you for listening.